Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Our second case of the day, Pinter versus Village of Stetsonville. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
May it please the court, Mr. Steffes. My name is Bill Grunewald, and I'm before the court here this morning proudly representing Alan Pinter, along with my associate, Adam Marshall. Mr. Pinter lives in the village of Stetsonville. It's a municipality of a little over 500 people. He lives not directly, but practically directly across from a number of village facilities. One of those facilities plays a central role in the case today called the main lift station. And the main lift station is a part of the village's sanitary sewer system. It basically a gravity-fed system until it gets to two lift stations, one being the main lift station that mechanically pumps the sewage back into the system to continue its journey to its treatment plant. Your Honors, there's a problem with the village's sanitary system, and it's nearly a 40-year problem. It's in the record, it's been a problem since 1977, and it's water infiltration, storm water infiltration into the system itself. The water gets into the sanitary system, which is supposed to be a closed system, by three avenues. First, by leaky pipes. Secondly, by sump pumps that are illegally hooked up into the sewer system. And third, by drain tiles that are illegally hooked into the sewer system.
Counsel, is your nuisance claim based on the failure to maintain the sewer system or the failure to pump when the sewage arose to a certain level?
Justice Kelly, I think it's a combination of both, and I think they're intertwined. The problem, I think, is all admitted by the village, the evidence.
Can we look at them separately, or do we need to look at them together? That is to say, can there be a nuisance created simply by the failure to pump at the appropriate time?
I believe there could be, Your Honor. We have a nuisance. I think we all agree that there's a nuisance here. There's an invasion of property. It's a question of whether or not that nuisance is actionable.
Right. Well, and there's also a question of what you need to show at the summary judgment stage to maintain that nuisance question.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so what I'm wondering is, and the reason for my question was, is the standard of evidence you have to bring forward at summary judgment stage to survive different if you are claiming the nuisance is the failure to pump versus the nuisance is the failure to maintain?
Well, I think the failure to maintain, my answer to the question is no, I don't think there's a difference here, Your Honor. But I believe it's the facts are in front of us. It's a combination of what occurred here, and I think the combination of both lead to the nuisance allegation.
Counsel, isn't it easier for you to really bring a suit under a failure to maintain? Because the issue with the failure to pump is you would have to show somehow that they didn't meet some standard, right? And isn't that just, is this wrong standard a real thing, or is it just the system was leaky, the system took on water, this was a means by which they tried to abate the nuisance, perhaps, or deal with it, and they weren't successful. But if you try to bring your suit against just the failure to pump, what kind of standard would you be looking at that they didn't maintain? How would you ever prove that? What expert would say it has to be on the second rung or the fourth rung or before you had to pump? Do you see what I'm saying?
I think so.
Isn't it easier for you to really call this a failure? The nuisance is the failure to maintain. They chose to not fix it and to try to just deal with it when the rain came. But the issue is that these pipes leaked and all these things you just pointed out, correct?
Well, that's correct. I think both are easier for me because I think the village has admitted both in the record.
Right, but how do you show that they failed to pump?
How do we show that we failed to pump?
How do you show based on just some idea that they had of where, what level it needed to get at and they didn't do it then?
The record shows that I think it's admitted they failed to pump. And we're getting into a mixture of the two different exceptions. The ministerial duty exception and the exception for nuisance liability. I think maybe we always have that mixture when we look at these types of cases. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. I apologize if I'm not. But I believe that, it's a combination. And if it's, but separately, I think at least at the summary judgment stage, what this case is at, if we look just at the problems with the system, which have been around since 1977, and admitted what the problems are, would a reasonable person, or more appropriately, a reasonable juror, be able to determine whether or not that was activity that would constitute an actionable nuisance, a negligence, a prong of that restatement. And on the other hand, I believe a reasonable juror, again, I'm jumping, I understand exceptions here, a reasonable juror should be able to determine whether the policy was in effect, whether the village had a policy, and whether it was breached. I don't know if I got your point or not.
What's your best argument for an oral policy creating a ministerial duty?
Well, I think the best argument is we look at what we talk about as far as being ministerial. The cases have meted out certain factors or elements, if we want to call them elements, that of what a ministerial duty is. First, a specific time. Well, we have that. When the sewage meets the fourth rung, a specific mode, well, you pump to bypass, and a specific occasion, which would be the high sewage in the system. You know, the village has a system of, before they even monitor these lift stations, they have a system, an alarm system, where the water level is communicated to the two village employees, and I don't know if that's by a phone call or by a text, I simply don't recall from the record. So I think we have that met. Now, perhaps the question more succinctly is it appropriate to have an oral policy create such a ministerial duty? And if we look at the rules in Wisconsin that other cases have looked at, it is that a ministerial duty is imposed somehow by law. And we've said that at a minimum, it has to be an act of government. And I believe we have that here. I mean, we have the former head of the Department of Public Works of the village of Stettsville set forth orally the rule of thumb, if we want to call it that, that at the fourth rung, you have to pump. And we have it very clear in the record from the two employees that if once it's past the fourth rung, it's too late. The pump can't keep up. Both have said that. Now, there's a factor. I mean, we're talking about the environment. We're talking about sewage, which isn't pleasant by stretch of the imagination. Neither myself, Mr. Pinter, the village wants sewage into the environment. But this rung policy is set forth after all of the alternatives have failed. Now, that didn't happen in this case because they took them out of order. But the idea of the policy, we believe, is that if you're watching it and it's coming up, if you've had the taker trunk there, it's still coming up, well, you've tried to save the environment. You've tried to do that. So your last step in saving the environment is to prevent that to going into your residence basements, which it ends up in the environment anyway, either through Mr. Pinter's sump pump or the fact that it just seeps through his basement. So the environmental harm is there in any instant. It's unfortunate in this particular case that they didn't pump their policy.
Counsel, I want to focus your attention following that question, on oral policies versus written policies. And of course, you cite several cases that involved oral policies. And in the petition for review that you filed with this court, you made reference to oral policy. Yet I note in footnote 4 of the Court of Appeals opinion, in clarifying what the issue is, they in essence say in the second paragraph of their footnote, look, the issue here, they say in that footnote, isn't whether it's oral or written. The issue is whether the alleged policy was definite and absolute enough to create a ministerial duty requiring village employees to respond to high water levels in a specific way. Is that the real issue?
Well, I believe that's part of the analysis, Your Honor.
Well, they say that's the issue. They say in footnote 4, you argue it's not uncommon for courts to recognize municipalities' oral policies, and of course, several are referenced in your brief. But they say that's not the issue. The issue is whether whatever policy it is, it was definite and certain enough to come within the umbrella of ministerial duty.
Well, they say that the Court of Appeals says that in its footnote. It doesn't necessarily say that in the body of its opinion. It basically at least intimates in the body of its opinion, as did the trial court, that you just can't have an oral policy. Because oral policies are susceptible of not being certain and definite enough. Somewhat of a circular point, at least in
hypothetically speaking, let's say that looking to other jurisdictions and the cases that you've cited, I think of the batting helmet case and also the suicide in jail case and others, you cited a number, that, you know, oral policies can be specific. For batting practice, wear a batting helmet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it's oral. That was what that, well, there was Kansas, I forget what court it was. But focus on why the policy, this oral policy, was definite and absolute enough to create a ministerial duty requiring village employees to respond to high water levels in a specific way. That's what I want you to focus on.
All right. Well, we have the deposition testimony of the two employees and of the village presidents. That's what we have for the policy. And it is remarkable to me that, they can be read different ways, I suppose, but it's remarkably how consistent their testimony is. The testimony is at the fourth rung you pump. Now, Mr. Duhlman testifies that the fourth rung, you have the machine, the pump ready to go. If it continues to rise, you start pumping. In my mind, Your Honor, I think that's a definite enough policy as if it were a written policy. But we're at summary judgment. We're where we should have a trier of fact. If I'm not granted summary judgment, which I think it's certainly within the realm of maybe perhaps my expectation, if not possibility, we should have the ability to have a trier of fact to determine that very issue. Is this oral policy definite and certain enough? And we could have that, actually, with a written policy, if a written policy was poorly written. And in my years of practice, I certainly have seen poorly written statutes and policies from at every level of government. sometimes you're scratching your head as to what they meant. So if we need a jury to mete out what if this particular policy, from the deposition testimony that we have, again, I think it's remarkably consistent, but if we need a jury to mete that out, we should have that ability. It shouldn't, I think we, at a minimum, got over the hump as far as opposing a motion for summary judgment is that particular issue.
In thinking about cases in the last decade or two where we have grappled with the ministerial duty exception. I can't remember us, and it could be my lack of recall on this, I can't remember us saying it's a jury question to determine whether or not it is definite and certain and time, mode, and occasion, leaving nothing to discretion. I can't remember us saying that's a jury question. It seems to me we've always answered that question as a matter of law here in a variety of ways, I acknowledge, but we've answered it rather than saying it's a jury question to determine whether or not that test was met. Can you respond to that, maybe?
Well, frankly, Your Honor,
I've read
the cases, and I think in every case it has been a written policy. Mm-hmm. It has been a policy that, at least in the context of what the courts were dealing with at that time, was unquestionably definite and certain. Context, I don't think the court, and I don't mean to use a term loosely, maybe has leapfrogged that, or just it wasn't an issue to determine whether these written policies were definite and consistent enough to be a ministerial duty once breached. There is no municipal liability. I don't think it's an issue that the courts faced, quite frankly.
Well, can you address why you think you don't need an expert testimony?
Well, that's a good point. And actually, the rhetorical answer is what would an expert tell us?
I don't know about sewer systems. I mean, I've had a flooded basement, but I don't know what causes it or whether that – really, the issue here would be whether it's a failure to maintain it.
Well, we have a village ordinance that says it's a closed system. You know, I'm meeting that down as
the ordinance says it's a closed system.
Yes, and it makes drain tile hookups and sump pump hookups illegal.
Mm-hmm.
We have a admission from the village. Admission's hard. I mean, they just acknowledge the fact that they have a problem with the leakage because of those two reasons and because of the old pipes. That comes from the village employees and the village president himself. And we have to look at, maybe the question really is, in a sewage backup case, do we need an expert as a matter of law? And that is, something that you could read the Court of Appeals and determine that that's what they did.
Well,
we
counsel,
really need to look at...
Counsel, what isn't one of the reasons that we sometimes require expert testimony is so that we can figure out what the standard of care is, right? So the question here, you say the village has not done its job in maintaining the sewer system. Okay, that may or may not be true. But what we have to know is what standard were they supposed to hit? Yeah? And then we can look at the evidence in relation to that standard and say, well, they were either above or below what that standard required. But how is a jury supposed to know what that standard is unless there's expert testimony?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that with the facts that we have here, it's within the realm of common knowledge or ordinary experience that if you're letting
so let me just sharpen it up for you then a little bit. So so there's apparently rainwater getting in. There's apparently water from other sources that it's illegal to tap into, right? And so I suppose the question could be, well, you know, how much rainwater gets into well-functioning systems, right? I mean, is there a certain amount of seepage into a closed system that is considered to be acceptable? How much, you know, is this standard in village sewer systems across the state, or is it the fact that if you have a closed system, there's no rainwater getting into that at all, right? A juror's not going to know that. How are they supposed to know that?
Well, I guess I disagree with the point. I think that with these facts, the jurors should have the opportunity to determine that. Now, the question
well,
of
are they, what, or do, should they have the opportunity to decide what the standard is or whether the standard was met?
Well, I think it's common negligence.
It's what? I'm sorry, what?
It's common negligence. I mean, the juries always have the ability, with, of course, proper instructions from the court, to determine negligence.
Right. So in generally speaking, you know, we have medical malpractice cases. We always have experts, right?
That's correct. I would believe so.
Yeah. We don't allow a juror to say, well, you know what, my experience, the reading that I've done, my understanding is that when you use a scalpel for a brain surgery, this is where you should go and this is where you shouldn't, and this constitutes, you know, a failure to meet the standard. They don't know that sort of thing, right?
Well, I'd agree, and I agree that if you didn't have an expert in a medical malpractice case, you're probably not going to survive summary judgment. But in an automobile case, you would. In an automobile case, in fact, I just settled the case in the village of Stetsonville where someone ran through a stop sign, T-bone accident. I didn't need an expert as far as the causation of that accident. I think that's within the common knowledge of an individual, and I see that.
So is it your position then? It is within the common knowledge of your average juror what the standard for maintenance of a sewer system ought to be.
Well, with the facts of this case, I believe it is.
Counsel, I thought your argument was more that it's within common knowledge that when the village has an obligation to pump and sewage comes up in someone's basement, it's based on the negligence of the city to have pumped it before that occurred. I thought that's what you were saying.
Well, I think it's a combination. I think that's why I when I addressed Justice Kelly before, I thought that the nuisance is a combination of the two things. Mm-hmm. And when we address, I don't want to cut either one of you off, but when we address the expert issue here, we really have to look at the Menick decision. That's what what's the Court of Appeals, what the trial court based its decision on. And that decision, the court's been acknowledged by this court a number of times in different ways. But in Menick, the plaintiff had five different arguments as far as the wrongness of the sewage backup. The one that is pertinent here is the argument that it was based on strict liability. Basically, if you fill up my basement with sewage, the municipality is liable. We're not there. And the language from the case is that not only did the plaintiff not provide any expert testimony, but she did not advance any theory of liability supported by specific allegations of negligence on the part of the city. So I think that's where we're here now. I think we do have specific allegations of negligence on the part of the village here. As this court has said in the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District case versus City of Milwaukee, asked to Menick, that Menick correctly noted that negligence-based nuisance requires proof of causation, which may require expert testimony if falling outside of the realm of experience and comprehension. I believe that we've shown that. Certainly there may be an argument that I won't endorse, but there may be an argument that we have not. But shouldn't a jury decide that? I think we've made enough of a jury to
let's pressure test that a little bit. So you tell me, what is the standard for a village to meet in maintaining a sewer system?
Sure. The standard would be that it follows its ordinances, that it does not allow the illegal hookups, that it maintains its system to not have leaking sanitary sewer pipes that allow this.
So how much leakage is acceptable in a municipal sewage system? Zero, or is it something other than zero?
Well, I think it would be fluctuating, but in this case, we know it was too much.
No. We're talking about the standard right now, right?
Well, jury.
I need to have you. I want to test this idea that that the average juror would be able to figure out what the standard is supposed to be, because I can tell you, I have no idea what the standard is supposed to be, right? I don't know how much water is acceptable to come into a sewage system and still call that a reasonably functioning sewer system. I have no idea. I don't know what the acceptable state of repair of pipes is in a sewer system. Is it always supposed to be brand new? What stage of deterioration is acceptable? When do you have to replace it? What is the standard of decay when it requires replacement? I don't know any of that. Do you?
Well, I think it's a matter of scale. Certainly, and it could be a defense expert that comes in and says that, you know, if this amount of volume isn't a problem.
Okay,
but here we're talking about the scale. We're not talking about the munition wrong.
We're not at scale yet. All right, so scale is going to be, does your evidence show that they did not hit the standard? The step that we're at right now is figuring out what's the standard. Yeah?
I would say that the standard is that you should not have a system that allows this problem to continue and contribute to the overflow of sewage into your residence, your citizens' basements.
So the standard is res ipsa loquitur.
No, I don't think I would go that far. I think with these particular facts, we don't need a res ipsa argument, and we haven't made that argument. I believe that...
If it's not res ipsa loquitur, then where do we draw the line?
Well, res ipsa is the thing speaks for itself.
Right. Something must have gone wrong.
And in the Menick case, I think they argued that also, that there's sewage there, we don't know why, but it's either strict liability or res ipsa. Here we have specific factors as far as... I'm over my time, but as far as the and specific facts, as far as what happened here, what occurred to ruin Mr. Pinter's basement. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ryan Steffes. I'm here today representing the village of Stetsonville. I'd like to begin by correcting a potential factual misunderstanding. I want to make clear that there's no evidence in the record in this case that the village chose not to fix some known defect in their sewer system. In fact, the evidence would show that within 4 years of the incident at issue here, the village replaced a large number of the sewer pipes. The village periodically used cameras to go into the pipes and look for cracks or leaks. Whenever village public works employees got into residents' houses, for whatever reason, they would check to see whether there was one of these cross connections that was prohibited by ordinance, that being where a sump pump or drain tiles are hooked into the sewer system. The evidence is that there's only four backups in over 40 years that this system operated. And for the most part, those backups were minor. And in fact, in the deposition testimony in this case, there was even evidence that private waste haulers and other municipalities bring their wastewater to the village and pump it into the system because the system operates well. The simple fact is that rainwater can infiltrate wastewater systems even if those systems are properly maintained.
Council, why wasn't there a ministerial duty on behalf of the village to pump when it got to the fourth ring, which had been their past policy?
I think there's numerous problems with relying on that past oral policy to say that imposed a ministerial duty. The first problem is that if Mr. Dahlman, if the water had gotten to that fourth rung and Mr. Dahlman had thought that nevertheless a backup could be prevented without doing the bypass, and he chose to start bypassing nevertheless, he actually would have been violating a genuine ministerial duty because there's DNR regulations that apply to operators like Mr. Dahlman that say you cannot pump untreated wastewater into a public waterway. And the department may approve doing so only in these very limited factual scenarios. And
did he have to get permission from the DNR for any other time that he decided to pump?
He did, yes.
He had to get pre-approval from the DNR on the day that it's filling up with water. He had to get pre-approval?
Not in this case, no. That's not what I'm saying. What he would have needed to do on the day that he decided to pump was determined that bypassing was necessary to prevent the loss of life or severe property damage. Okay. But also importantly, he had to determine that there were no other feasible alternatives. So if he believed that the using these pump trunks is working and is going to prevent the backup, he can't just say, well, I'm gonna bypass it anyway. Because once he does that, he runs afoul of the DNR rules that say only bypass when you've reached the point where you don't believe there's a feasible alternative.
There was something in the record about he didn't bypass that day because he didn't want to fill out the paperwork. What about
that? Well,
that's the DNR paperwork, I assume.
That's the DNR paperwork, and that's right. A characterization that comes from someone else. Mr. Dahlman would say that he was doing his best to balance these two competing interests, not flooding residents' basements, but also not pumping untreated wastewater into the local river.
How often in the past has he pumped, do you know?
The record is silent as to right. that. I think it's a rare occurrence.
Okay. Council, so it's not in the record any place for us to look
at. It is not.
Thank you.
Council, I'm not sure that line of argument actually gets you anything. All that does is back up earlier when he should have been making the decisions, right? So if the village's position is, well, you know, this is, look, it's a long and complex decision-making tree that he has to work his way through before he decides to pump. Okay, fine. I'll grant you that. That just means he should have started the decision tree earlier, doesn't it?
Well, if we're talking about immunity here, we can assume he was negligent and that in the benefit of hindsight, he should have pumped earlier.
Right. So let's put immunity to the side for a moment. The question of whether this was negligent is just a question of timing then, right? He should have started making this decision process earlier than he did.
That's correct. And I think there was a question from one of the justices during the initial argument as to what do you need to get these two different negligence theories to a jury? And I would say if you set aside immunity, there is sufficient evidence to argue that Mr. Dahlman was negligent in not pumping sooner. We don't dispute that. We contend that claim fails only because immunity exists. Now, the same is not true of the negligent maintenance claims. For reasons that this court hit upon in that initial argument. The other point I want to make about the oral policy is that it's probably generous to even call it an oral policy. I think the best description is a personal guideline of the predecessor of the man who was in charge of the sewer on the date of the backup in question. There's really no logical reason why Mr. Dahlman should be bound to follow the personal guideline of his predecessor. And in fact, in the deposition testimony in this case, Mr. Smith, the other village employee, testified that as much as a year before the incident in question, Mr. Dahlman had made clear that in high water situations, he wanted to try to do everything without doing a bypass. And I think that's a reasonable philosophy for the sewer operator to have.
What happens if it's acknowledged, and this admittedly is a hypothetical, say it's been acknowledged that there is an unwritten policy that when the level rises to the fourth rung, you pump, right? And that the village says, yep, that's right. It has never been anything other than that. We've never written it down. Originally came from an employee who says, yeah, you know, if you don't do it by the fourth rung, you're not going to catch up. And we've always done it that way. Is that a sufficient policy to establish a ministerial duty?
I don't think it is, because you run afoul of the same problem. The policy isn't originating from an employee with policy-making authority, and it's not being communicated to municipal employees in a way that they want. Understand what the policy is.
Right. So let's take all that out. Right. Let's say the village every single time it brings on a new operator, it says, you know, by the way, it has always been the practice of the village to pump by the fourth rung. If you don't, you're never going to catch up, and that's going to create problems. Is that sufficient to create a ministerial duty?
Under that hypothetical, it may be. I think the question I would have there is it also communicated to the employee that it's your job duty to comply with this rule and to make clear that you do not have the discretion to alter this standard. Even though this standard came from somebody who previously filled your position, not from the village board or from some higher authority, if the village board is saying essentially we haven't codified it because we haven't put it in writing, but we've given this our seal of approval.
Right.
Your job duties require you to do this. I think under circumstances like that, you may be able to get an oral policy that truly imposes a ministerial duty.
Okay.
That's not this case.
Doesn't that make that a jury question then?
Well, I don't think it does. There's no evidence of this case that the village board codified or otherwise adopted Mr. Dannon's rule of thumb.
Well, we're setting aside the codification, right? We're just saying this is a this is a policy and a, well, this is a practice and a custom. This is the way we've done it time out of mind. It has never been done differently, and everybody knows that, right? If that's sufficient to create a ministerial duty, doesn't it become a jury question to decide whether, in fact, that's true, that that's the way everybody understood this was to be done?
But I don't think that there's evidence to support that view of the evidence in this case. It's a hypothetical because you've altered the facts from this particular case.
Right. But then it's just a question of the continuum, right? This is then a sufficiency of the of evidence question. Are you going to be able to convince a jury that this has always been the way it's been done? Are you going to be able to convince a jury that this is the understanding of village employees, that this is their obligation and duty? Doesn't that become a question of fact?
Well, I don't think so. And you run into this other problem of what did the policy actually mean? It's very easy for this court to determine what a statute or an administrative code provision or a written policy means, because you can say, well, it means what it says. And we have certain rules that we apply for interpreting these things.
Yeah. This one's not that hard, though, right? I mean, this one is fourth rung. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. By the fourth rung.
Well, that's not what Mr. Dahlman testified. He testified that this was a guide that we used while the previous public works employee worked here. He only ever understood it as a guide, and it was clear from his testimony that, yeah, this gives you an idea of when you might want to start thinking about bypassing, but you also need to be considering, is the water rising? What rate is it rising at? Is it still raining? Is the pump truck working? How much wastewater can the pump truck remove? So I don't think there's sufficient evidence in the record here to say, yeah, this was the rule. In fact, Mr. Dannon, he wasn't deposed in this case. There's no evidence as to what he understood his personal guideline to mean. It's all these second and third hand accounts that, well, the fourth rung was something we looked at when we made this decision. It wasn't the only thing they looked at, though. And there's no reason that Mr. Dahlman should have been bound by Mr. Dannon's personal guideline. In your hypothetical, you say this is a policy from time immemorial, from the beginning of the sewer system. Well, there's no evidence in the record in this case as to when Mr. Dannon came up with his personal guideline. It may have only been 2 or 3 years before this incident.
So is it the village's position that the operators of the sewage system, they go out every day, and every day is a brand new day, and they have no idea what they're supposed to do when the water rises?
No, I don't think that's the position of the village at all.
So what are they told is the responsibility when the water rises?
Well, they're not told anything from the village board, because the village board leaves these decisions to the quote-unquote man in charge of the sewer. Where they get their direction from, and the reason why their discretion is not unlimited, is because of the existence of those DNR rules that say, okay, the base rule is you cannot bypass. You can't pump untreated sewage into a public waterway. However, there are circumstances in which we may approve you having done so. And here are those circumstances. It was done to prevent the loss of life, personal injury, or severe property damage. And I note that the administrative code provision doesn't say property damage. It makes a point to say severe property damage.
Well, would you acknowledge that Pinters have suffered severe property damage?
I think in this particular incident, yes. However, much of their argument in this case hinges on the fact, well, there were previous backups. Well, the evidence is that those previous backups were actually quite minor. I wouldn't concede that any backup constitutes severe property damage, regardless of the severity of it. But even more importantly, those DNR regulations say there's got to be no feasible alternative.
So would you be willing to concede that the village has an obligation to pump so that the sewage does not back up into village residents' basements?
I don't know that they necessarily would. That was certainly their intention here. They were certainly willing to bypass once they reached the point where they believed we have to bypass.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand the breaking point here. So there is no duty on the village's part to pump so that sewage does not back up into residents' basements.
The DNR regulations do not impose that duty.
Now, I'm not asking about what the DNR does. I'm asking what the village is. I mean, people of the village might want to know this.
Right.
Does the village understand itself to have no duty to pump in such a way that it prevents sewage from backing up in the basements?
That certainly was not the village's policy in this case. And, in fact, the village was actively trying to prevent that backup.
So does the village understand that it has a duty to pump such that the sewage does not back up into residents' basements?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a ministerial duty imposed by law because, again, there's not a statute or administrative code.
Is there a duty or not? I mean, you either have the duty or you don't. And if it's just a kind of, well, you know, we'll do our best and whatever happens, happens, well, then say so. You know,
well,
there's no, and say there's no duty. We just do, you know, basic best efforts.
Well, I think their position would be we try and balance these two competing interests, which are both very important to us.
Which is the other interest?
Not bypassing into the public waterway, not pumping untreated wastewater into the public waterway.
Right. But when the options are, we're going to back this up into people's basements rather than pumping it into public waterways, what's the correct decision?
We pump. Yeah, we absolutely pump. And the minute that Mr. Pinter said, it's flooding, they pumped. They started the pump and started pumping. And now I note that they ran that pump for an hour.
Yeah.
And then after that, they spent 3 hours again using pump trucks to ferry water.
Isn't it too late at that point, though, if Mr. Pinter lets the village know that there's sewage backing up into his basement? At that point, the system cannot handle what's happening, right?
Again, It's easy to look back with the benefit of hindsight and say he should have done it differently. And, in fact, I think we can assume that the village was negligent because, again, this is an immunity question.
An immunity question. That's the threshold question, not negligence.
The village is conceding negligence here, then.
No, we certainly didn't concede negligence, but for our purposes here today on summary judgment, we should assume the village was negligent because the only basis we're entitled to summary judgment on the claim relating to the failure to pump sooner is immunity. So as we all stand here today, we should assume that Mr. Dahlman was negligent in not pumping sooner.
And the immunity is based on the proposition the village does not have a ministerial duty to pump in such a way that the sewage does not back up into residents' basements.
Correct, because really the village is being asked to sort of thread a needle here. Because the DNR regulations are themselves imposing.
No, don't go to the DNR. This is just a question of timing for the DNR, right? There, you can pump into public waterways. You just got to do the groundwork first.
But you don't know. This isn't a case where you get an alert saying, oh, at 8:30 a.m. There's going to be a backup. In order to prevent that, we need to pump from 7:45 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. It doesn't work that way. It's a question of judgment and discretion. You look at where the water is in the holding tanks. You look at the rate at which it's rising or falling. You consider how much rain has fallen, how much is predicted to fall in the future, You get the pump trucks going, which they did almost immediately. You see whether they're keeping up or are going to be sufficient, and you do your best to meet both requirements.
But isn't the absence of an alert system one of the reasons, ostensibly, that the policy or guideline or whatever you want to call it was developed in the first place? Because if the water gets to the fourth rung, we're done. There's going to be sewage in residents' basements.
Well, I don't think there's anything in the record that indicates that. There's nothing in the record to indicate when, how, or why Mr. Dannon came up with the supposed fourth rung standard. It's simply absent from the record.
Counsel, only if you're finished, yeah. Tim. Let's take a look at the record and also let's take a look at the duty that as it is applied to this record. Now, a duty is a duty, of course, under the circumstances. There's never a duty to prevent injury. Oh, there's injury, therefore you're negligent. You know, it's a duty under the circumstances. And what does our myriad of cases explain that duty if it's going to be ministerial? And that is, it's ministerial only when it is absolutely certain and imperative, involving merely the performance of a specific task, when the law imposes, prescribes, and defines the time, mode, and occasion for its performance with such certainty that nothing remains for judgment or discretion. So time, mode, and occasion, leaving nothing to discretion. With regard to this fourth rung, I read the briefs in that part of the record that I read, it seems that there was a discrepancy with regard to the fourth rung. That is, one, there was testimony from a former village employee, Chad Smith, testified that the policy was the portable pump would be put into place if the water rose to rung six of the ladder, and if the water reached rung four, the pump should be turned on. But that wasn't the policy that had been told by former Mike Dannon, as I understand it. That testimony was, if you can see four rungs, quote, you're getting close to where you might have to start bypassing. So you've got the import of the fourth rung. It seems there's an inconsistency there as to what triggers things. Am I right or wrong, or am I misreading that?
I think there clearly is. I think that the fourth rung was one factor to be considered by the employee who was in charge on that particular day. That's how Mr. Dannon understood it.
And with regard to whether to use the pump or the truck, what is the testimony given those two choices?
Well, that's another interesting point and another inconsistency, because you have Mr. Smith, one of the employees that Mr. Pinter relies on, to say, well, he said this was an absolute imperative certain duty. But on the other hand, Mr. Smith says, well, it's better to use the pump trucks as long as they're able to keep up. Well, that just begs the question, how do you determine whether they're going to keep up? And again, it's, you look at all these various factors. Is the water rising or falling? How much are the pump trucks removing? How much does the water rise when the pump truck goes to dump its load at the treatment plant? Is it still raining? I mean, it's by its nature discretionary. You're trying to determine, when do I have to bypass in order to prevent severe property damage? You don't want to just say, well, boy, it's been raining, we better start bypassing. Because then you're running afoul of DNR rules that say, oh no, you can only bypass when you have no feasible alternative. So if you think the pump trucks are sufficient to keep up, I would argue that you have a ministerial duty to use the pump trucks and not to bypass. So in that circumstance, it makes very little sense to say, oh, he had a duty to bypass. Because then what you're really saying is he had one duty to violate another duty, the one he was subject to pursuant to the DNR rules. I just don't think that can be. This was by its nature a discretionary determination. It's exactly the circumstance, because whether it's a negligence or a private nuisance claim, The immunity analysis looks to the nature of the underlying acts. Here, the underlying act is the decision of when to pump, if and when to pump. And I don't see how that decision can be anything but discretionary, because as Mr. Dolman said, yeah, I consider where it is on the rung. That's just one factor. That gives you an idea that maybe you better start thinking about bypassing. But what if the water is no longer rising? What if the pump trucks are keeping up? What if it stopped raining? It's a decision that requires weighing all those factors. And here, the goal was to prevent the backup and to prevent the bypass. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. The one thing I was going to note was that after the bypass occurred for an hour, they went back to using the pump trucks for 3 hours. Now, that decision worked, but it created the risk of another backup.
Why is the decision to bypass or use the pump trucks relevant?
Well, it's relevant because when you use the pump trucks, you haul the waste to the treatment plant, and it gets treated before going into the river.
Right. So I'm imagining the village residents aren't particularly concerned about that at that moment. They're interested in keeping the sewage out of their basements, right? So I think the duty that they're interested in is, how do you get that sewage out of the system so it's not in my basement? Yeah? It seems that the oral tradition, to some extent, and I, you know, the record is not as clear as my hypothetical made it, but it was, you do an alternative by the fourth rung, right? Whether it's a pump truck or a pumping into the ditch, one way or the other, you're doing something extraordinary to keep the sewage level from coming out further. And I think that's the standard. I think that's the ministerial duty the residents are interested in. Do you have a ministerial duty to make a decision to implement an alternative so that it keeps the sewage out of our basements?
If you're going to say that there is any ministerial duty here, I think there's a problem as how does it arise from law, from a statute or an act of government. But if there is a duty, it's a duty to act, to do something. Well, here the record makes clear that they did something. Within minutes of getting the high water alarm, they called the pump truck. The pump truck was there and pumping within, I believe it was 30 minutes of the high water alarm. They had employees monitoring both stations. It's not as if they just sat back and said, "Oop, let's cross our fingers and hope this works out."
And that part might go to whether they were negligent or not. But as far as whether there was a ministerial duty, couldn't the village residents say, "You have a ministerial duty to take some action. You choose which it is. But your ministerial duty is to take some action that will prevent the sewage from coming up in our basements, and it's the fourth wrong thing."
Well, I think under this court's jurisprudence, a ministerial duty arises from an act of government, typically a statute, an administrative rule, a written policy. I don't know how you can say an administrative or a ministerial duty just arises because that's what the residents of the village would probably want.
Well, we talked about that earlier, right? So, you know, the question of whether this fourth rung was really a village policy, that we could say, you know, there's your ministerial duty. And that's a question of what the record shows as a factual matter. Right?
Well, I think you still get, if you're going to have a trial on this, you still have the problem of you're turning a question of law, whether something is a ministerial duty, into a question of fact. And then you have the further problem of whose understanding of this personal guideline was controlling.
Yeah, let me just back you up for a second there. The ministerial duty is always at some point going to be a question of fact, right? It's always going to start as a question of fact. Do you have a policy? Is it written down? Where is it? Introduce the policy. That's a factual matter, right?
But I think determining what the policy means and whether it imposes a ministerial duty has always been a question of law.
Yeah, so our first step is to figure out, is there something that requires you to take an action? And then we'll figure out, you know, what does that mean and what does it mean in this circumstance and all that. But this threshold question of immunity requires, as a factual matter, that we first determine whether there is something that creates a ministerial duty. And whether it's a writing, and, you know, and the plaintiffs have to produce that as a factual matter, or it's an oral policy, and they have to prove as a factual matter that there is an oral policy, either way, that's a factual question, right?
Well, I think it's important to note that the Court of Appeals didn't say in its decision that an oral policy can never impose a ministerial duty. And I don't think the court, to resolve this case, has to find that an oral policy can never impose a ministerial duty. The question is whether the oral policy in this particular case could have imposed a ministerial duty. And I don't think it could have. The first and most fundamental problem, as I see it, is I don't see any evidence that would support the conclusion that the policy was binding on Mr. Dolman, or that he should have believed it was binding on him. It was nothing but the personal guideline of his predecessor. He held the same position that person held. Surely he had the same authority to craft his own standards. Now, this case would be different if the village board had said, okay, we think this policy makes a lot of sense. We're going to make this our village policy. Here it is, policy number 32-6. Wastewater sewer operator, if you see the water get to the fourth rung, you have to bypass. This would be a different case then. Even if the village board had enacted a resolution to say, this is our policy, we're not going to put it in writing, but it's going to be orally communicated to every future public works employee who's charged with operating the sewer, and he's going to be told, if the fourth rung is met, you have an absolute duty to pump, and it's within the scope of your job duties to comply with this policy, even though we've chosen for some reason never to put it in writing.
Yeah, what if the circumstance was the village knows, the contractor, whoever they've hired to do this, the operators, they know, you know, this is what they do. They pump at the fourth rung. And we're good with that. We like that. So we're not gonna intervene. Can we use our standard set of tools to say, well, the village knew or had reason to know this was the standard that was being implemented, and they took no action to change it, and therefore that was approval of the standard?
I don't see how the court could do that given the evidence in this case. Again, there,
no,
I see my red.
But keep in mind that we are at the summary judgment stage, and we're trying to figure out, as a factual matter, was there something extant in the village that created a ministerial duty? And with knowledge in mind that we can look at circumstances and derive from that a duty, shouldn't we send that to the jury?
I see my red light is on. Can I answer?
Yes, I think you can answer that question.
Yeah. I think what you would need if you were going to go down that road is evidence in the record as to when this personal guideline was developed, why it was developed, what the person who developed it believed it meant. We don't know that. How it was communicated to the village board, how it was communicated to others. And for the most part, all of that evidence is lacking in this case. It's all second and third accounts of, well, Mr. Dannon thought the fourth rung had some significance. That's all there is. So I don't think that can be sufficient.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
May it please the court, Adam Marshall on behalf of Mr. Alan Pinter.
So, Mr. Marshall, how is the village to be taxed with the operator's personal guideline?
Well, thank you, Justice Kelly. I believe, regardless of this nomenclature, it's a policy. You can call it his own personal guideline, the former employee's guideline.
But isn't it important whether it's his guideline or a village policy? Doesn't that make a difference?
Well, I would say that it makes a difference as to whether it's a policy or not of the village. And I believe that we have two employees of the village and the president of the village testifying that it is, in fact, the policy. Whether it was created by a former employee doesn't have any bearing here. We have three people testify who were the employees on that day that said this was the policy that should have been followed. and it was not followed. And I feel that it's important to highlight briefly the timeline we're looking at here, because I believe a lot of things were kind of implicated in Mr. Steffa's response. First, there is an alarm system. That's how these employees were notified to go to the lift station that morning, and they got that notification at 7:45 a.m. Mr. Dulem and Mr. Smith went out to the north lift station, and then at 8 a.m., Mr. Smith sent Mr. Dulem down to the main lift station. It was at that time that a hauler truck was called in to the north lift station, not the main lift station. Then between 8:20 and 8:40, we have Mr. Pinter stepping out of his home, going up to Mr. Dulman, stating, "Our pipes are gurgling. Something's going to back up here. We know this is going to happen. It's happened before." At that time, Mr. Dulman says, I'm watching it. I'm noticing it." And very important to note, that hasn't been brought up, at this time, between 8:20 and 8:40, the water was at the second rung. We're talking about this fourth rung policy, and as you go up, you start losing rungs. It was at the second rung at this point. So whether or not the policy was, look to see if rain is still coming in, it certainly was. Look to see if the water level is still rising above the fourth level rung, it's at the second level.
Right.
And
so
we know
gets,
it's still going.
So that gets you, if you can get past immunity, that gets you a really good case of negligence. But the question is, can you get past immunity, right? So what do we? So Mr. Steffes says, well, you know, the record's kind of spotty on what this standard was, and you know, there's a whole lot of factors that go into how rapidly the water is approaching the fourth rung, you know, what the forecast is, and how much more rain is expected, and all of that. So doesn't that factor into whether there's an actual policy that creates a ministerial duty?
Well, Justice Kelly, I believe that the policy as testified to was that at the fourth rung, action needs to be taken. And that was clear between across all three village employees who testified.
So what if the he's standing there watching the water, and he sees that the rate of increase is decreasing. He sees that it's sunny out now and there's no more rain, and it's just barely creeping up to the fourth rung, and then just barely touches it. Is there a ministerial duty at that point to pump?
Yes. From the policy as testified, under that hypothetical, I believe absolutely there's a ministerial duty to pump at
that
point.
And if to a metaphysical certainty the operator knew that water's not going to come up an inch higher, there's no possibility of that, and actually shortly after this, I know it's going to go down. Still has a ministerial duty to pump.
Absolutely. Okay. Pump at four was what was testified.
Is it to pump into a truck to be hauled away, or is it to pump and I think they delivered it to a ditch that then took it to the creek.
Right.
Which duty to pump is it?
Thank you, and I believe that's incredibly important for us to clarify here. The duty to pump that we're speaking of is to bring out a portable hand pump that they have for this specific occasion and to pump the water into the ditch. Because that's one of the questions, this policy was created after all of these other backups have been happening to say, this is how we prevent it. This is how we prevent that backup. So we have this portable pump that we bring out because we know when it hits four, we can't keep up with it. A sewer's backing up. And important to note, because there's a lot of talk about hauler trucks, oh, that's more easier on the environment because it goes to a sewage plant. They know at four they're not keeping up. So that's why this immediate action needs to take place. We know for a fact it's going to keep going back into somebody's home. Use the manual pump. Now, it's talked about this hauler truck that was called out, and one was at the north lift station. But important is to go back to our timeline. When did a hauler truck actually get to the main lift station? Well, looking there, we know that at 8:50 a.m., shortly after, maybe 15 minutes after Mr. Pinter was out at the main lift station, his wife calls and said, sewage is coming in. It's flooding. In fact, we have fountains come up as high as 4 feet of this spewing into the basement. Shortly after...
Counsel, your red light's on.
Oh, I apologize. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you. It's a very interesting case, a little bit different take on ministerial duty or the lack thereof. And thank you for good briefs and a nice argument. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back at 1:30 for our third case of the day. We are adjourned.